From South Carolina Public Radio, this is the South Carolina Lead. I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode was recorded on June 12th, 2024. What a Wednesday. Yes, in South Carolina Public Radio studios here in Columbia. That's right. On this episode of The Lead, we look at the 2024 June primaries that occurred on Tuesday. That's why it's Wednesday. And we have a full recap of the major races with the Associated Press's Jeffrey Collins. We have further insight and analysis from our Election Night show with Winthrop University political science professor Dr. Scott Huffman, as well as the state party chairs, Republican Party Chairman Drew McKissick and Democratic Party Chairwoman Crystal Spain. So stay tuned, and a little bit of programming notes, I should say. This is our only podcast this week because your boy's tired. And there's also no wind down. I know you probably need the wind down today. I'm sorry I cannot give it to you. We have so much information. And also, your boy is tired. Now, just because there's no wind down doesn't mean you can't call. You can call 803-563-7169. Tell us what you want us to know. Tell us how you voted. You can show us your ballot. No, just kidding. Don't do that. We're not gonna play that coffee rant about who lost and who won. But, you know, maybe we might. We'll see. But we also have discretion over our calls, folks. But give us something lighthearted to talk about. Because it's summertime now and your boy is tired. AT's tired. He has that baby. Tell him what he needs to do to raise a strong little baby, Rena. 803-563-7169. Rena! Alright folks, we're doing a little double dip here with this week in South Carolina's upcoming episode, and this episode...
Why?
That's because I am but one man.
No way.
And your boy's tired. I am but mortal. So to start y'all off with, we're going to look at the top races from Tuesday, which included major congressional district primaries, as well as some surprises in the state Senate and state House. To do that, we're talking with the Associated Press's Jeffrey Collins, who is a master of all things statehouse and gives us some great context about all the major races he was covering Tuesday night. Jeffrey Collins of the Associated Press. Jeffrey, welcome back to This Week in South Carolina.
Thank you. Have I gotten enough punches on my card to get the free tote bag?
Not yet, Jeffrey. Oh. But if you become a member, we can hook you up with some swag easily. But
thanks.
Jeffrey, we're taping this episode on Wednesday, the day after the primary elections, which we saw several key congressional races happen. Of course, there are no statewide races, so that really didn't help drive turnout much. We saw turnout at about 13.5%. Primaries are never really big vote getters, but still pretty lackluster right there. But let's talk about congressional races, since they were the biggest races on the ticket. Down in the Lowcountry, in the first congressional district, we saw Republican incumbent Nancy Mace fend off challengers Catherine Templeton and Bill Young by wide margins. She won that race outright, no runoff needed there. She also got the major endorsements from the governor and former President Donald Trump. So tell us about that race and maybe some surprises you saw come out of there.
I think the margin was a surprise. I don't know necessarily that Nancy Mace coming out with the win was a surprise, but the margin was a surprise. And just, you know, I think the first lesson that gets learned by the political establishment in South Carolina should be, don't come at Nancy Mace from her right. They've done it a couple of times and she's won pretty handily. I think the other interesting lesson may be for Nancy Mace herself. I mean, you know, everything that she did over this second term, when you get more than 50%, 6% of the votes, that's kind of the voters telling you, we're good with all that. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure Nancy Mace will hear that loud and clear. And then there becomes a point where the longer you're there, you know, the things that people complain about her or are like, oh, she's this or that, all of a sudden become nice quirks. She becomes your congresswoman. She becomes that person that, you know, we know well and everything. Now, eventually you can wear out your welcome. Mark Sanford would tell you that. Bob Inglis would tell you that. But right now, I mean, Nancy Mace should, and very well should, be on top of the world. She chose right. She got back in favor of Trump. The whole Kevin McCarthy thing barely made a dent. So, mm-hmm. you know, she's got to feel really good right now.
Yeah, there's a lot of outside, millions of dollars of outside money in that race, too. And again, still wide margins there for her to win by, especially against Catherine Templeton, who was her biggest challenger. She was that 2018 gubernatorial candidate who unsuccessfully waged that campaign against McMaster back then, too. So, very surprising, but also not surprising. And I think empowering, like we're saying, because we do start to see that character development when we talk about South Carolina politicians, yes. And she's well on her way at this point.
I mean, I think you know who, well, you know who Nancy Mace is to a certain extent. I mean, she may do something surprising tomorrow. I think that's just kind of part of her independent streak that's in her. But I mean, ultimately, she is establishing herself as a force in South Carolina politics, no doubt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of those eight Republicans that voted to oust McCarthy, like you're talking about, but then also a lot of turmoil in that office, too. So we'll see how things go going forward. Of course, she'll go on to face Democrat Michael Moore, who narrowly defeated Mac Duffer to be the Democrat nominee. But like all Democrats in these contested races in the Congress, besides the 6th Congressional District, that's an uphill battle because the U.S. Supreme Court just made that district more conservative, upholding that redrawn congressional map.
You know, so South Carolina, I mean, we seem pretty locked into 6-1, six Republicans, one Democrat for a while. I mean, there are some outside forces that can happen. I mean, Joe Cunningham ran a very good campaign and had some local issues that helped him out. But I mean, that's a very much an uphill climb. And it's just redistricting across South Carolina has been like that. The theme of the 2020 redistricting was to make the conservative districts more conservative and more of them. It also makes the Democratic districts more liberal, but there's very few of those ultimately in comparison. So the redistricting and we will end up in a situation here where, and I think Scott Huffman, the Winthrop professor, mentioned it yesterday, where we have primaries are where the action is and where the decisions are made and where we choose our candidates as voters.
Yeah, we saw that. And of course, when we're talking about such big decisions and that low turnout, it's a recipe for folks who really want to get back into office to do so and say, oh, well, you can get this settled at the ballot box. Well, when you talk about gerrymandering, you're talking about certain things in play, it's a little bit more difficult to make your voice heard. But of course, that's the way it goes in the state. But let's go up to the upstate, Jeffrey, with the 4th Congressional District, a very hot race right there. We're talking about Greenville and Spartanburg counties. We had a challenger there with House Freedom Caucus Chairman Representative Adam Morgan, who said that Congressman William Timmons was not conservative enough for a fourth term, even though he had a very strong conservative voting record here. What happened in that race?
It's very interesting. Williams Timmons, if he's not the most conservative U.S. House member in South Carolina, he's certainly very at the very top of the list. You know, he had the Trump endorsement too, and ultimately, though, you know, he still squeaked by. I mean, we talk about Nancy Mace at 56. Timmons was around 52%. Mm-hmm. I just think, in some ways, for whatever reason, William Timmons is one of those people that he's always going to have to be in a tussle in the Republican primary. He's always going to have a fight there, because for whatever reason, he just doesn't click in the, you know, the way an incumbent typically clicks in that district. Mm-hmm. And keep in mind, they do churn through people in that district. Yeah. I mentioned Bob Inglis earlier. That was his district until it wasn't. I mean, once the voters in there were convinced he wasn't conservative enough, you know, Trey Gowdy just waxed him. And I mean, so that's a part of it too, is that's just a very conservative place where I don't think the voters are ever fully satisfied. I mean, even if you look at state house races, the state house churns more in the upstate than it does in the low country PD or anywhere else. New candidates come in and win more often than they do in other places.
Yeah, and of course, when you saw Adam Morgan really challenging him from further right, of a part of the House Freedom Caucus, a fringe of the House Freedom Caucus, when I heard Timmons really talking about how he is in line with a lot of those folks who will represent the Freedom Caucus up in D.C., and he's worked with leadership. He's not the loudest voice in the room, but he's one that's pragmatic and gets things done. We saw the governor on the campaign trail with him on Monday, which was fascinating to see because the governor didn't get involved in too many races, but he did get involved also in the 3rd Congressional District race, Jeff Duncan's open seat there, too. Of course, Jeff Duncan retiring because of some marital issues that threw off his family values vibe. And that was something that was also in play, too, in the 4th Congressional District with William Timmons' marriage falling apart as well during his time. So that was a big push to get maybe see an opening there with Adam Morgan. But of course, that fell flat. But over in Jeff Duncan's district, in the 3rd district, also in the upstate, very conservative, there were 7 candidates in that wide open race, Jeffrey. I mean, how did you see that play out? You know, you had the spectrum of folks on the ideological spectrum there.
Yeah, I mean, you had a sweep of people, but ultimately, what did we come down to? Sherry Biggs, who is a nurse practitioner, who is endorsed by Governor Henry McMaster. He's been friends with the Biggs family for a while. Mm-hmm. They're donors. And on the other side, you got Mark Burns, the pastor who has been in Donald Trump's corner before he became the Republican presidential nominee in 2016. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the end, when it sorted out, it ended up being probably the two biggest factions in the Republican Party, mm-hmm. and factions that in the Venn diagram overlap quite a bit. I mean, you know, both Henry McMaster and Donald Trump will tell you they're good friends.
Yeah.
So that's going to be the question is, can that more establishment kind of Republican that McMaster represents, is that going to win the day in the 3rd? Or are people wanting like that kind of firebrand that's going to go up there and make waves and pound the fist and fully throatedly support Trump. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody, all Republicans, mostly support Trump, but he has this little extra benefit to it. So is that going to be what wins the day? The third's going to be a very interesting, probably the most interesting of the only congressional runoff we have.
There we go.
Yes.
And of course, we're going to see that on June 25th. So any idea maybe how that might consolidate when we look at those seven candidates now going down to two when we're talking about Sherry Biggs and Mark Burns? Mark Burns, who also ran against William Timmons at one time as a primary challenge, and now, I guess, getting into this runoff for the third congressional district.
Third time was the charm for Mark Burns. He lost twice in the fourth district, you know, before running in the third this time around. Mm-hmm. It's a good question. I mean, you could probably make an argument that the Stuart Jones supporter would be someone that would be who finished third, mm-hmm. would be someone that might move more into the Burns corner, but maybe not. And the, you know, Kevin Bishop, the former communications director for Lindsey Graham, mm-hmm. you know, his people you might think would be more establishment, but maybe not. And there's probably going to be a lot of money put into play. Both candidates have been willing to loan their campaigns a lot of money, mm-hmm. and you imagine that's going to continue in the runoff. And with such a sprawling, spread out district, I mean, it's hard to see. It's you can door knock and everything, but you know, that district is it's probably 100 miles from one side to the other. That's mm-hmm. a lot of territory to have to cover in 2 weeks. So yeah. I suspect you'll see a ton of cash and a ton of TV.
Yeah, turnouts could be key there, especially in these runoffs. But of course, even fewer people vote in runoffs too. So a lot of work ahead for the third congressional district for the Republicans, at least. But we're gonna let's go to the State House really quick, Jeffrey, with the South Carolina Senate. It's set to be younger, more male, and more conservative come next session, due in part to the ousting of two of the several so-called sister senators. And then a third is now in a runoff, too. I'm talking about Kershaw Republican Senator Penry Gustafson, who lost to Alan Blackman, Johns Island Republican Senator Cindy Sinn, which, if a recount confirms, will have lost to Representative Matt Lieber by 31 votes, and Lexington Republican Senator Katrina Schilly, who's facing a June 25th runoff against Carlisle Kennedy. So tell me about the Senate, what we saw in play with those Republican women, and how that's shaking out.
You can't ignore abortion. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what brought the sister senators together, was to coalesce to fight a near total abortion ban in mm-hmm. South Carolina. And even though there are a couple of Republicans, male senators who joined in that effort, you don't hear much about them, but the sister senators, you know, they got the John F. Kennedy Profile and Courage Award. They didn't hesitate to appear with each other and to talk about what they did. And that kind of attention, I think, is at least a pretty significant role, obviously, in that. That's the link that kind of bonds the three of them to a certain extent. I mean, there are some other factors, too. I mean, Penry Gustafson, she's, you know, her district got redistricted. And mm-hmm. so, like, the main component of her support got pulled out of her district, and she never was able to kind of regain her footing on that. You know, Sandy Sinn has had an up and down kind of relationship with her own party. And it's funny, you know, again, to go back to redistricting, Sandy Sinn had a race where she won by just a couple of percentage points in 2020 against a Democrat. So when they redrew her district, they made it more conservative, Sinn more usual Republican voters, but that opened her up from attack from the right. Mm-hmm. And Katrina Schilly, 60% of the voters in her district did not vote for her. You know, she got 40% of the vote. Second place, Carlisle Kennedy was about 34. So she's got her work cut out for her. I mean, can you win from that position in a runoff? Certainly you can. Does it make it really hard because suddenly there's all these forces against you? She's going to need to work at it.
Yeah, and you were talking about that District 41 race with Sandy Sinn and Matt Lieber. And Senator Sinn spent $246,000, so she had raised that much, whereas Lieber raised $102,000. So, again, really just showing how much that abortion vote really played out there, too, when we're talking about that near-total abortion ban. But so does that mean, Jeffrey, looking forward to the next session, you know, senators are up every 4 years, that we're going to possibly see a more conservative abortion bill go through the State House when we talk about a near total abortion ban that they helped prevent before? Now it seems like the votes are there to prevent a filibuster.
The chances certainly increased. I think there's still some more questions out there. There are two Senate runoffs for open seats in the upstate where there's a pretty decent delineation between a little less conservative candidate and a little more conservative candidate. And each time a little more conservative candidate wins, the chances of this happening go up. So, I mean, I think it's going to be one of those deals where the leadership in the House and especially the Senate are going to wait until November and see where everything stands. But yeah, I mean, I certainly wouldn't be surprised if abortion becomes an issue next year, especially with the trends the way that they're going right mm-hmm. now.
Yeah, we have a couple of minutes left, Jeffrey. I want to wrap up with the Senate. Over on the Democratic side, we saw State Representative Russell Ott's gamble to upset Senator Dick Harpulian here in the Midlands District 26, which was also redrawn down even to Calhoun County, which really helped favor Russell Ott there. A bit of a gamble, like we're saying, but it paid off for him. Walk us through that race, because it was kind of a surprise to see.
You know, it tells you that old school local politics works. I mean, if you look at the numbers, Calhoun County turned out amazingly strong for Russell Ott, and it made up the difference because, you know, Dick Harpootlian did win by a smaller margin, Lexington County and Richland County. But, you know, Ott has been in Calhoun County all his life, along with his dad. They are very well known, and they turned out in droves. And, you know, most of Harpootlian's campaigning was trying to point out that Ott may not be a strong voice to protect abortion, but, you know, that kind of TV and mass media campaign just didn't take root. It was that local go knock on 4,000 doors kind of thing that worked out for Russell mm-hmm. Ott. And, it, you know, give him credit. I mean, you know, he had a very safe House seat, but he decided to walk off the cliff and he ended up flying. So that's an impressive feat.
Every House member's dream, right?
Well, they would disagree with me, but yeah, I think you're probably right.
Speaking of the House,
maybe Jeffrey, other than Merle Smith. He had a chance to run, but no, you know, he passed on that open seat.
But it'll be interesting to see, because Russell did support some of those abortion motions over in the House. So I'm sure once push comes to shove, when we're talking about a near total abortion ban being inches away, he'll side with the Democrats and really probably object to that at that point. Hard to say, but we'll see.
It's a difference when you have a little bit of cushion and yeah. where the margins are very slim in the Senate. I mean, right now they're one seat away from a two-thirds majority, which they wouldn't have to worry about filibusters. So, yeah, being a senator, you don't have as many places to hide mm-hmm. behind a vote as you do when you're one of the, you know, one of more than 100 people in the House.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the House, Jeffrey, a big upset over in the House was a win for the House Freedom Caucus, that far-right group of Republicans in the chamber, and that was Labor, Commerce, Industry Committee Chairman Bill Sandifer, who was ousted by Freedom Caucus-endorsed candidate Adam Duncan, who's a wrestling coach from Seneca who's never held office before. So big move there, talking about those outsiders in the upstate really kind of driving a lot of these folks. And that throws the LCI committee in flux, too, because not only was he the chairman of that committee, which really oversees a lot of utility regulation bills, some big ones going through right now too, but the vice chair on that committee, Belton Republican Representative Jay West, who's also the House Assistant Majority Leader, also lost. So a lot of things happening in the House. Talk to us about those races and what it means for the House Freedom Caucus.
Well, and there's some retirements on the LCI committee too. I mean, the LCI committee, the Republican members in it, they are just mostly gone. So I think you'll see a pretty big overhaul of that. They're probably gonna have to find somebody from another committee to come in and be the chairman or the chairwoman of that committee. But mm-hmm. you know, ultimately the state house races were interesting because the Freedom Caucus held its own. Mm-hmm. And for them, that's a win at this point. I mean, you know, 2 years ago, they ran races kind of under the radar. They won, they got their foothold into the Republican Party and the House politics. This year, they could not hide. They had to run out in the open. They had a lot of money and forces behind the establishment Republicans, and they held about the same number of seats, maybe added one. We'll see how everything shakes out when people decide they're going to say they are a Freedom Caucus member or say they aren't. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it just goes to show you that while Freedom Caucus members struggled in a wide geographic area, like the 3rd Congressional District or the 4th Congressional District, mm-hmm. when you put them in a much smaller thing, the 170 little mini races we have in South Carolina yeah. across the General Assembly, they can still be a force, and they can, you know, obviously goes back to gerrymandering and the way districts are drawn. They're small enough, turnout is small enough that you're going to have the most conservative people show up, you know, for the 10% of the people that show up in the district to vote. And as long as that happens, I think the Freedom Caucus is probably here to stay, at least for a little while.
Yeah, definitely got some wind in their sails too, especially when you're talking about how much money that the House Republican Caucus put into these races too. We're talking about millions of dollars. And again, you're talking about how the Freedom Caucus held their own there too. So a little bit of a shot across the bow there for the Republicans in the House.
Well, and you know, Governor Henry McMaster actually went out and campaigned for like Jay West mm-hmm. and some other people. He had some wins, he had some losses, kind of like everybody did. But I mean, just the fact that they drove McMaster, who's a, you know, an old school Republican, believes in that 11th commandment that thou shalt not speak ill of a fellow Republican. They got him to rouse up and make these endorsements. Mm-hmm. Says something.
That commandment's been out the window for a while now, right?
Yeah. Well, yes. I think Henry McMaster still believes in it, but yeah. you have to be, it tends to be more of an old school kind of Reagan remembering Republican that goes that direction.
Now for some more analysis, we turn to the guests I had on the Election Night show that South Carolina Public Radio's Mayon Schechter co-hosted with me. We'll start off with some takeaways from Republican Party Chairman Drew McKissick.
The elections are to begin with about turnout, and as you pointed out in early voting, it's up about 20,000 votes over what it was in 22. Republicans outvoted Democrats about two-thirds, so 80,000 to 40,000 generally. And it's interesting to see where the turnout's up versus where it's not up or even down. It's up, obviously, in the upstate. We have the 3rd and the 4th congressional district, very hotly contested primary races there. But you've also got a lot of state House and state Senate primaries going on in that area as well. In some of those counties in the 3rd and the 4th, turnout has been up either double or even triple what it was in 2 years ago, versus the other areas of the state and even the low country where it's been down or a little flat, which is interesting because you have that hotly contested primary in the first district, and they spent about $9 million, and turnout seems to be flat. So I don't know what that says yet. We'll look at the rest of the numbers tonight.
What do you see when you have these the wide open race in the 3rd congressional district? Obviously, it's anyone's to go after. So we were talking about just having a wide spectrum of folks up there. What do you see when it comes to the Republican Party in South Carolina, specifically the upstate, in terms of what messaging is registering with folks?
Well, obviously, it's a more conservative area of the state, say, versus the low country. And, you know, you have an element of populism up there, too. But you've got a lot of candidates. And so it's kind of hard, really, to tease anything out of this, probably until we get to a runoff, which is probably what we're looking at there. Shake them up in a hat right now. I think the top three leaders right now, I don't know if you could pick which two are going to be in the runoff. I think it's going to be very close. But, you know, it's we live in an age of a nationalization of politics now. And so the issues that, you know, move people in, you know, across the country are some of the same issues that move people here. It's, you know, the border, it's immigration, it's the economy, it's interest rates and so forth. And it's changed what is used to motivate voters a lot over in recent years, just because media is 24/7 now and it's all national.
Republicans have had great success in the last two cycles. In 2020, flipped 5 seats, 3 in the Senate, 2 in the House. I don't really need to remind you, probably.
I can quote them for you.
And then in 2022, y'all had a very successful year in the House in districts that, I mean, Democrats probably should have.
We have not won in 150 years, as a matter of fact.
Right. So I know we're all focused on tonight and what happens tonight, but obviously your focus is also on November.
It is.
And so coming from tonight, I mean, where do you see Republicans going in November? You see more seats flipping?
I do. You know, I'm already on record, so I might as well say it here, that we should net 2 state House seats this year. We should net at least 2 state Senate seats. Could be a third if the wind blows hard enough. Those opportunities are there for us. Again, presidential race is going to drive a lot of turnout. And you know, you and I have talked before about our success on the straight ticket here in South Carolina. So we're one of, I think, 8 states that still have straight ticket voting. The first time in history that we beat Democrats on the straight ticket was in 16 by 2.5 points. In 18, it was 8 points. In 20, it was 17. In 22, it was 27 points statewide. That helped a lot of those down ballot candidates in those races you were just referring to a minute ago. That, you know, the governor's race, et cetera, helped carry a lot of those in with straight ticket support. It'll be interesting to see how much more that grows or settles out and what areas of the state that we see more success in. The PD particularly, I think we're going to surprise a lot of people there this year.
We also had Winthrop University political science professor and author of the Winthrop Poll, Dr. Scott Huffman, who had this insight on some of Drew's takes.
As Drew pointed out, the South Carolina Republican Party is changing, but it's changing in really interesting ways. The old way of looking at the South and politics was the Deep South and the Rim South. You know, and again, this goes back to the Civil War. The new way of looking at the South is the growth South and the stagnant South. And in the growth South, people are moving in into urban areas and they're becoming more Democratic. And you think of Georgia. South Carolina is a little bit of an exception of that because a lot of the growth is coming in on the coast. It's retirees. They're bringing in some native conservatism. And, you know, Drew McKissick and the Republicans are able to take advantage of that. But it's fundamentally changing the party. And one of the things that I wanted to ask Drew about was, you know, he has so many primaries in his party where you have standard, you know, run-of-the-mill traditional Republicans running against, you know, January 6th, supporting domestic terrorists, supporting 2020 election deniers. And that is changing the inner working of the party. And one of the reasons that's happening is because the districts are so horribly gerrymandered that there is not any real competition. And the women who are getting beaten up over the abortion votes, well, you know, when you talk about the general public in South Carolina, the general public is in favor of legal abortion for many circumstances, many things. But if you are running in a primary where you will have no general election competition, and so in your primary, you have to run the furthest to the right, if you dare to be moderate, you could lose out. So that is how we're ending up with a legislature where elected officials who actually reflect what the general population of South Carolina believes are getting shoved out of the way. With the six-week ban, you see a minority of people supporting that. However, that's the real people of South Carolina. The people who vote in the primaries are very different. They are fundamentally much more to the right or much more to the left. So they elect candidates in the primaries that don't reflect the South Carolina general population, including, you know, non-registered to vote folks. And when they go on in a gerrymandered district and have no opposition in the general election, that's how you get laws that are truly not reflective of the general population of South Carolina. And, you know, we're not in the only state this happens in. There's only a handful of states that demand that either a nonpartisan or a bipartisan committee redraw electoral district lines. The main way it's done, which is how we do it, and most states do it, the legislature gets to redraw their own districts after a census. And shockingly, those districts turn out to favor their party.
And for the Democratic Party perspective, we also spoke to Democratic Party Chairwoman Crystal Spain, who is aware of the challenges folks in her party face in the increasingly Republican state and what she says they have to focus on come November.
We've seen, and especially in some other states where abortion has been such a top issue, and obviously you heard Scott Huffman talking about the polling numbers today. Is that something that you expect to see a lot of Democrats talking about ahead of November?
You know, I do. In 2022, that's how we flipped the seat with Representative Heather Bauer and Kirkman Finley. She ran on abortion, and I don't think that much has changed. I think that abortion is a mobilizing issue. It mobilized a lot of folks to run for office. This cycle, we had around 400 folks file for office because of abortion, because of book bans, because of attacks on LGBT rights. So it's mobilizing. It mobilized people to run. It's mobilized people to run for office, and I do believe that it's going to mobilize voters to go to the polls. Let me slow down.
Okay.
No, I mean, you know, look, Democrats, we're South Carolina Democrats. We know we have to fight. Nothing's going to be easy, and we're going to fight for every seat. We're going to fight for every district. So nothing you said was incorrect. The district has gotten harder, but as I said earlier, we've got quality candidates running right now. We'll see who comes out of that, but they're going to be prepared to run and run hard. And that's basically all we can do. Reach out and talk to as many voters as possible and get them to the polls in November. Down in Beaufort, where we have, you know, most of all the folks running in the Beaufort County elections are women. And they were mobilized for abortion and book bans. Like, they were just really, they're running to help defend democracy. They don't like the state of things. We talked about politics being nationalized. And I think that it has benefited us because it got our candidates off the sidelines and into these races.
Yeah, and Crystal, before we let you go, I want to just ask you what it's going to look like after tonight. There will be some runoffs possibly, but when it comes down to what the next few months look like for Democrats, when you just heard SCGOP Chairman Drew McKissick say that they're looking to flip some seats, how are y'all going to combat that? Are you going to get some national resources? What's the outlook?
Yes, we're going to get national resources. They're coming right on in after we finish this segment. there. But no, we're going to be talking to our voters, and we don't have any statewide races. We're going to be very targeted in the races that we're going after. We're going to go back to get our seats back that we lost in the State House, and we're going to defend our state Senate seat. So we're going to be very targeted and very focused on our work.
If you want to rewatch that entire election night show, you can do so on youtube.com/South Carolina ETV. And now for the outro. Thanks as always, folks, for listening to the podcast. Thank you. I need that. Keep clapping. You can always show us your appreciation by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or a voicemail at 803-563-7169. You can stay up to date with the latest news on scetv.org and southcarolinapublicradio.org. And don't forget to support your local newspapers. The South Carolina Lead is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Amy Crouch is our supervising producer. Sean Birch is our executive producer. This podcast is produced with support from PRX and is made possible in part by a grant from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, as well as listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. For the South Carolina Lead, I'm Gavin Jackson. Be well, South Carolina. You boys tired.
30. I believe you're a pursuer.
You're talking about pursuers?
Oh my god, I would punch that guy in the face.
Ew.
I want you to talk to a customer service person like that, please.
Pursuer?
No, I need a higher insurance premium.
I was at one of your establishments and they had a Thrasher shirt on, but they did not skate.